Hi, Marco Werman here. Thank you for making the world part of your world by tuning into the show every day. We are grateful for your support. This year, the holiday season looks a lot different. Here at The World, we know what it's like to feel out of touch and uncertain about the future. That's why we strive to bring you honest stories that connect you with people around the globe. One thing you can be certain of is that The World team is dedicated to bringing you the coverage you need. Right now, though, The World needs you. Specifically, 578 dedicated listeners to donate $100 each to reach our goal. That's just $8.33 a month to support the stories we bring you each day. You can make your donation at theworld.org/give. When we make the goal, and I know you'll get us there, I'll host a virtual celebration with the World team and send you an invite as a thank you for your support. Right now, go to theworld.org/give, and from everybody here at The World, thanks very much.
Heads up, fans of The World. We're putting a little something extra in your feed. Things That Go Boom, a bonus podcast to loyal listeners of The World from PRX. Things That Go Boom. Let's roll.
In a small Pennsylvania town in 1957, two kids are out making out at Lover's Lane when they see a meteorite crash in the distance. A young Steve McQueen jumps into action.
Boy, that was close.
But he's too late.
What happened?
It's over at his place. You gotta come now.
Oh, wait a minute, Steve. Tell us what happened.
But what was it?
Well, it's kind of like a mass that keeps getting bigger and bigger.
The creature is the one, the only, the Blob. It's totally indestructible and can't be stopped.
And there's no stopping the Blob as it spreads from town to town.
There's panic.
It's indestructible. It's indescribable. Nothing can stop it.
There's hysteria.
Before long, the nation and then the world could fall before the blood-curdling threat of the Blob.
The movie was so wildly successful that it was kind of, weirdly, Steve McQueen's big break. Within a year, he was capturing outlaws unwanted, dead or alive. And the movie lived on, too. From an actual movie reboot in 1988 to, well, a Washington reboot in 2016. In recent years, the term the Blob has become a derogatory shorthand for Washington's foreign policy insiders. But the debate over who exactly qualifies for membership in the Blob is a lot more important than the insult might let on. Because how that debate plays out could determine the future of foreign policy under the Biden administration and beyond. I'm Lacey Healy. And on this episode of Things That Go Boom, we're going to talk about the Blob. Hey there, it's Lacey. It's been a tough year, but some good things have happened too. We elected our first female vice president. We managed to connect with family and friends in ways we never thought possible. And Inkstick Media, which is the organization that produces Things That Go Boom, we moved officially into the nonprofit world. We are our own thing, which is really, really exciting. But it also means that there's a lot of pressure on us to continue to exist, which means we need your help. So in a year of firsts, we're taking a little chance and we are doing our first fundraiser in order to continue to bring you the news that you want and need. In order to remain objective, we've made a choice to rely on listener support to drive our coverage, which has been and will remain independent and free of corporate influence. Important stories like Season 3's first episode on our coronavirus preparedness, World War C, those should be freely available to everyone. But they're not free to produce. It takes us a month to put together a single episode. And that's even after we've spent months researching and planning our season. We spend countless hours in an effort to support this community of people who are just as passionate as we are about digging deeper into foreign policy and national security and the issues that drive the decisions that we make. And that's why we need your help. If Things That Go Boom is something that you've come to rely on over the course of the past 2 years, please go to inkstickmedia.com/donate and make a donation today. Please consider giving just $5 a month. It's convenient for you, provides ongoing support for Things That Go Boom and Inkstick Media, and you'll feel good knowing you're helping make things that go boom freely available to everyone. Always. We know that Things That Go Boom is important to you because you're listening. So go to inkstickmedia.com/donate today or check out the link in our show notes. Just $5 a month makes a huge difference. Thank you for listening and, as always, for supporting our show. To help explain what the heck any of us means when we use the term the blob in foreign policy, we called in two analysts with experience in the subject. Ben Armbruster.
I am the managing editor of ResponsibleStatecraft.org, which is the publishing platform of the Quincy Institute.
And Emma Ashford.
I'm a senior fellow at the New American Engagement Initiative in the Scowcroft Center of the Atlantic Council.
When did you first hear the term the blob?
So I first heard the term the blob when I was reading this article, and it was all about the life and times of Ben Rhodes.
Ben Rhodes was one of President Obama's speechwriters, who today you might know from the show Pod Save the World. And in the article, which ran in the New York Times Magazine in May of 2016, he doesn't pull any punches.
And right in the middle of the article, there's this quote where he says, you know, the reason we can't do anything good in the Middle East is because there's this blob.
This blob that all thinks alike, which, according to Ben, included Hillary Clinton, former Defense Secretary Bob Gates, and other Iraq war promoters from both parties who, quote, whine incessantly about the collapse of the American security order in Europe and the Middle East.
I think it was intended to be maybe a throwaway, maybe just a private insult.
It didn't matter. The term the blob took off.
And it took on such a life of its own that, you know, it has actually appeared in serious academic journals and major books and certainly in the press a whole bunch of times.
But Emma told us the definition of the term is not as clear-cut as it might seem.
I have no idea what the blob is. I actually ran a poll on Twitter a while back where I asked people, tell me, am I part of the blob or not? And I think it was 55% I'm not, 45% I am. So nobody else knows either.
Some people are just using the term to mean Washington insider. So folks who work in the government or at think tanks.
Other people are using it to mean anybody that shares a certain view of U.S. foreign policy. So if you think the defense budget should be bigger, if you think the U.S. should still be fighting in Afghanistan for another 20 years, if you sort of subscribe to that classic liberal interventionist approach to foreign policy, then you're part of the blob.
The debate that's taken on a life of its own in Washington since Ben Rhodes coined the term the blob, which, by the way, might actually have been coined by another guy in a 2012 book called The Payoff, but that's neither here nor there. This debate is really about something called the liberal international order. Support for the liberal international order has been the single most consistent theme of U.S. grand strategy since World War II. Put more simply, this means that the key goal of U.S. foreign policy dating all the way back to World War II has been to uphold the same series of institutions, rules, and alliances.
The experiences of a long life have wrought in me the conviction that there is nothing more important for the future of the world than the fraternal association of our two peoples in righteous work, both in war and peace.
When the order was established, it featured the U.S. as the central figure, which was kind of the point. It was meant to solidify America's status as number one without getting on anyone's bad side. And what we learned is that members of the blob are in favor of upholding the status quo. And they believe that the best way to do that is to remain the dominant world military power.
There's not a building called the blob and they all go to work at the blob.
Right. That's Ben Armbruster again.
But it's an insular circle of people who have been around U.S. foreign policy making for decades.
On the other side, there's a group that's come to be called restrainers, or for the purposes of this conversation, the anti-blob.
And that includes classic academic realists.
The real question is how destructive these regime change wars are on the people in the countries where we are supposedly trying to help them, as well as how destructive they are to us.
The anti-war left.
War is a horror. And it's time politicians understood that we have got to do everything humanly possible to avoid war.
libertarians that want to reduce the size of the defense budget.
We need to ask ourselves whether borrowing millions of dollars year after year to fuel our appetite for more military spending is a wise policy.
Just a lot of people that want America to be, if not less engaged in the world, then less engaged with the military.
We have 800 bases around the world. Why do we need 800 military bases? Why do we need to spend $1 trillion a year on national security, $700 billion at the Pentagon? You know, these wars that we've been in since 9/11 have amounted to what?
We should be working with our allies. We should be de-escalating because war is not good for anyone.
There's a sense of that, you know, we need to sort of pull back from some of these foreign entanglements and reconsider not only who we are, but what our priorities are.
And this is where it gets interesting, because this blob, anti-blob debate sets the terms for an internal fight in foreign policy that is free from party lines, meaning Democrat or Republican, it just doesn't matter.
It's really not a political partisan distinction, this. There are sort of restrainers and primacists inside the Democratic Party, and there are restrainers and primacists inside the Republican Party. And it's not about Trump versus Biden either.
Actually, if you're going to put Trump into any camp, like you could put your finger on any level of consistency in his approach, he'd probably be a restrainer. But there are a ton of differences even within these individual camps. Take the restrainers, for example.
There are people on the anti-war left who have sort of always protested conflicts abroad, and they're arguing for an end to the forever wars. There are budget hawks who are coming at it from the point of view of we are just spending way too much and the deficit is out of control. There are academic realists who are sort of looking at the world and saying, wait, no, this is totally out of balance. We need to rein in our foreign policy or we won't have the resources to address the threat from China. And then there's other people that just argue that we could be perfectly safe, you know, with a smaller military. So there's a lot of different motivations here. You know,
the debate represents a shift in public opinion after almost 20 years of war, but also importantly, a shift among insiders in Washington who are starting to come around to the idea that maybe these past few decades of foreign policy haven't been so great after all. Emma says the story basically starts in the 90s. The Soviet Union had collapsed and America was far and away the most powerful country on the planet.
In Moscow, the hammer and sickle is lowered for the last time, and an era comes to an end.
The time even has a name, the unipolar moment, because it was just us.
America was just so much more powerful than other states. We could basically do what we wanted. Other states would typically go along with it. Or even in the case of things like the Iraq War, they would just grudgingly acquiesce.
There was this general feeling that the United States was unchallenged and could do pretty much whatever it wanted to do.
The problem is that in this period that followed the Cold War, the U.S. approach was really military heavy, which had been necessary to combat the Soviets. But soon, the liberal part of liberal internationalism, well, it started to shrink until you had something that looked more like a militant, muscular liberal internationalism, or even just militant internationalism. As centrist Democrats and Republicans converged around the idea that U.S. foreign policy was necessarily militaristic, those who disagreed were pushed to the fringes. And for a long time, those interests ruled the day.
And I think a lot of people in Washington have just never got over that moment. The idea from the 1990s that America, if it wants, can just go anywhere around the world, solve any problem, do anything it wants, intervene in any conflict.
Now the United States must protect our interests.
Except today, we're living in a very different world.
China is rising. European states are a lot more powerful than they were. The European Union is a much bigger player. There's a lot of small countries. India is rising. And this is not the world of the 1990s, but our foreign policy continues to be the same as it was during that period of sort of unmatched superiority.
And those groups that were pushed to the fringes, well, Democrat or Republican, right or left, they're having a moment.
Before the war in Iraq, the blob was largely unchallenged. And, you know, in the mid-2000s, you had a flood of young people coming to Washington to work on foreign policy who were upset about the war in Iraq and the war on terror and, you know, drone killings and assassinations and troops everywhere, and started to infiltrate these organizations because there's nowhere else to work, and started to ruffle some feathers a little bit.
Ben Armbruster was one of those young people. He started as an intern at the Center for American Progress, or CAP, a progressive think tank, in 2005. Around that time, CAP's media outlet, Think Progress, was a pretty big deal. Ben and the reporters he worked with were outspoken and dogged. Their reporting tracked a lot of the concerns that today's anti-blob might have taken up. And that was all fine. Until 2012. Iran was a huge hot-button topic.
The International Atomic Energy Agency wants access to Parchin, a military site where inspectors believe Iran may have conducted preliminary tests for developing a nuclear warhead.
There are huge suspicions about what's happening.
Iran has, you know, denied again today that it's seeking nuclear weapons, but then you have Israel saying, of course they want nuclear weapons. You have the United States.
We
you
know, believe there is still time and space to pursue a diplomatic
Britain
solution.
Played a leading role in helping to deliver an EU-wide oil embargo.
Iran's nuclear energy program was looking more and more suspicious, and Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was pushing the U.S. to intervene. As far as we can tell, this is where one of the first skirmishes in this coming war between the blob and a new generation of foreign policy practitioners that would come to be known as the anti-blob broke out.
There was this notion emanating from the blob, let's say, that we needed to confront Iran and its nuclear weapons program.
There was no evidence that Iran had a nuclear weapons program at the time. Actually, our intelligence services insisted that it didn't.
The agency assesses Iran as unlikely to initiate or intentionally provoke a conflict.
They continue to develop their enrichment capabilities, but the intelligence does not show that they've made the decision to proceed with developing a nuclear weapon.
But that hasn't stopped U.S. politicians from talking tough. For weeks on Capitol Hill, there's been a push to build consensus that Iran is on the path towards building a nuclear bomb.
Polling was really bad on this issue because pollsters were asking people about what we should do with Iran's nuclear weapons program.
Remember, there was no program.
And of course, you would get these skewed results of Americans saying, yes, we got to take out their nuclear weapons with military force. And then you'd have the Iran hawks, you know, running around Washington, waving around these poles.
So Ben and his colleagues started writing. But back in 2012, the appetite for criticism of Israel in Washington, even criticism of decisions that might in some way impact Israel, was very limited. And pretty soon, things got ugly.
There were folks on the sort of more pro-Israel side of these issues who organized a campaign to essentially get us fired for what we were writing on Israel-Palestine and on Iran. And, you know, that just sort of set off this firestorm. I mean, we were being called anti-Semites, right? Like Jew haters. I mean, it's crazy.
Ben Smith, then of Politico, wrote that Ben Armbruster and his colleagues had deviated from the bipartisan consensus on Israel and voiced a heretical and often critical stance on Israel heretofore confined to the political margins. Basically, Politico called them out for writing stories that were anti-blob. Eventually, senior officials at CAP intervened.
And so everything on Israel had to be filtered through a special editor so that it didn't say anything that could be construed as anti-Israel.
They also censored what was published.
I was not allowed to write Benjamin Netanyahu's name in anything that I wrote.
Which might seem simple, except that at the time, Iran's nuclear program was such a big deal and Netanyahu was so vocally opposed. Well, he was in the news a lot.
It was definitely a time where you saw the clashes between some of the old guard, particularly on foreign policy, and some of the younger generation who were witnessing the United States get bogged down in these endless wars and trying to do something about it. And I think that was one of the first times that this blob, counter-blob internal debate really sort of exploded into the open.
But this isn't the first time the United States has had these debates.
This goes all the way back to, you know, the early days of the American Republic, right? We have George Washington in his farewell address warning against entangling alliances with other countries. So this is not a new debate. And I think the reason the debate has come back to the fore is because it has become increasingly apparent that America can't keep doing what it's been doing.
We are at this point stepping back and thinking about what we've done over the last 50, 60 years, how that resulted in some of the disasters that have unfolded in the last 20 years, and saying to ourselves, we obviously need to do something different because none of this is working.
And right now, this argument is playing out on both sides of the political aisle. Republicans deficits. Against Republicans.
How is it conservative to add $1 trillion in military expenditures?
I know that the world is a safer and better place when America is the strongest military power in the world.
And Democrats against Democrats.
Also, I am the only person up here to have voted against all three of Trump's military budgets.
Which is why, when we come back, we'll talk about the blob and Biden. In the spring of 2014, President Obama was traveling on Air Force One during a trip to Asia when the subject of his foreign policy came up. The president's recent failures in the Middle East and Ukraine had drawn a lot of criticism, and his so-called pivot to Asia was faltering. Just prior to the trip, China's Global Times had jabbed, "Obama always utters, 'Yes, we can,' but he has done an insipid job, offering nearly nothing to his supporters." The president was, by one account, fuming as he made the case for what he was trying to do to the press at the back of the plane. As he stood up to head back to his own cabin, he turned back to the reporters. "So, what is my foreign policy?" The reporters said in unison, "Don't do stupid shit." Obama's foreign policy, if anything, was marked by vigilance. He had the patience to conduct the kind of careful and well-thought-out diplomacy that led to the Iran deal, but also suffered from the kind of reluctance to act that led his administration to draw a so-called red line on Syrian chemical weapons and fail to follow through when they were used, which made "don't do stupid shit" look more like "don't do anything." Obama inherited two wars and a global economic crisis from the Bush administration, so any achievement or lack thereof should probably be measured against that environment. But he also oversaw more drone strikes in his first year than Bush carried out during his entire presidency.
These strikes have saved lives.
Armed and supported Saudi Arabia in its devastating war in Yemen.
Refueling aircraft, providing additional ordnance, providing
and
intelligence.
And gave a green light to over $1 trillion in new nuclear spending.
Of a nuclear confrontation between nations has gone down, but the risk of nuclear attack has gone up.
What could be called the Obama Doctrine or Obama's grand strategy did come to be known as "don't do stupid shit" or "stuff" if you were trying to be polite. But looking in the rear view, Obama never really seemed to follow his own advice, at least not in any way that might have helped him overcome the inertia of the blob. This is one reason why even some Obama alums are hoping that Joe Biden might take a different path. And where do they think that Joe should go? Well, for a better idea of how this conversation might play out, we reached out to Van Jackson, a professor of international relations at Victoria University of Wellington, who worked at the Pentagon during the Obama administration. He's also affiliated with a bunch of think tanks.
Center for American Security, the Center for Strategic Studies in New Zealand, the Asia-Pacific Leadership Network for Nuclear Nonproliferation.
The first thing we asked Van was where Biden himself, not Biden as part of an Obama administration, might fall on the progressive versus centrist, blob versus anti-blob spectrum, and what that might mean for U.S. foreign policy for the next 4 years.
So Biden as VP and Biden as senator was 100% of this third way establishment kind of mentality, worldview. And by every indication, he is still that guy. But one, you approach the river a second time and you're not the same man. It's not the same river, right? So like just everyone I've talked to, especially like they all acknowledge they don't want to repeat Obama. They know times have changed. And yet, substantively, I haven't heard any meaningful deviations from the Obama era.
Take progressive rhetoric on ending endless wars, for example.
Biden used the rhetoric of like ending endless wars in the campaign.
It's long past time we end the forever wars, which have cost us untold blood and treasure.
But then he always put on an addendum of, but we got to have a few hundred special forces troops in various parts of the Middle East, right?
And I think it's a mistake to pull out the small number of troops that are there now to deal with ISIS.
Which is still pretty much the status quo. But Van says that doesn't mean there's no chance Biden will move on this issue, or any other.
Getting somebody like Biden to endorse ending endless wars, that's not a small thing, yeah. You know? And so if the politics of the moment support positions that are more progressive, I think the Biden administration would not have a problem adopting those.
We'll know more, says Van, when we start to see more of Biden's staff. And not just the folks at the top.
A lot will come down to who the Obama-type people at the top end up choosing to staff them.
Mm.
And this is where the Warren team possibly matters.
We must refocus our security policies by reining in unsustainable and ill-advised military commitments and adapt our strategies overseas for the new challenges we see in this coming century.
He says, take a look at Elizabeth Warren's foreign policy team in the primaries.
A lot of them were disaffected, sort of former Obama people. So they had established bona fides as like foreign policy professionals. They know how the sausage is made, but they saw a lot of problems with liberal internationalism as conducted under Obama. And they were looking for an alternative path that was basically more progressive.
Van told us that when the primaries ended, the Biden team brought a lot of the Warren team into the mix. And there's a chance those folks might end up in a position to influence policy at the highest levels. I asked what happens if Biden goes the way that seems like it might be more likely and fills his cabinet with members of the blob. Is there a revolt?
Yeah, probably. I mean, like, Noam Chomsky doesn't represent everyone on the left, but his slogan during the Biden campaign was, vote for Biden and then haunt his dream. And that is a very succinct explanation of, like, how everyone I know on the left is thinking about Biden.
Yeah.
It's like, we support you precisely so that we can pressure you.
Yeah.
Right. And so, like, if that's the approach, it means that Biden is going to be catching shit from the left on a continuous basis. Like, that pressure is not going to let up, I don't think.
It's already begun. When Biden's initial transition teams were announced, they were some of the most diverse Washington has ever seen. 15 of 23 members of the Pentagon review team are women. But progressive groups were quick to point out that nearly all have ties to defense contractors, arguing that the groups lacked a diversity of thought.
Once policymaking actually starts, there's going to be a lot of criticism unless he moves left. But it's hard for him to move to left because he won on what was basically liberal internationalism. Like, that was kind of what he promised.
Beyond the shape of the teams that make up Biden's administration, one major and immediate area of contention, said Van, will be the defense budget.
The big domestic policy priority is going to be spending. And the classical progressive view is that defense spending, particularly at this like $740 billion, these like egregious levels that we've had it for the last decade or two, this is structural violence against civil society. And so the progressive theory of the case is that money that we spend on like the F-35 or the F-22 or hypersonic weapons, it needs to be reprogrammed for domestic purposes, particularly in the COVID era. And so like part of the world's problems will be reduced by reducing economic inequality. And so defense spending has to be reduced in order to increase welfare spending in effect. And that's an agenda in equal parts at home and abroad.
What this whole debate really comes down to, though, is a bigger question. Is America's grand strategy, as in the guiding principles that have taken us through the last half century and beyond, is it done? Do we need something new? Or, I asked Van, do we really need a grand strategy at all?
So I think so, yes, because it's about being deliberate versus just stumbling around and being reactive. Like, if other actors that you compete with are proactive and you're reactive, then they can literally box you into undesirable choices, right? But having a grand strategy does not mean you have to accept anything that we've done up to this point. Like, it doesn't have to be militarist. It doesn't have to be based on forward military presence. It doesn't presuppose any particular choices. It's more about being cognizant of the wagers that you make with statecraft and the risks implied in those choices and in the choices you end up not making. Grand strategy does all that. And if you don't have one articulated, then you don't know what the actual roadmap is that you're using. So that's a problem because, you may not be interested in grand strategy, but grand strategy is interested in you.
Are there ways in which we can box ourselves in, though, by laying those things out at the front?
So this is funny you mentioned that. This is a come to Jesus thing for me in recent years. But like, being a reformed Obama person, I think that I learned from the Trump era that we really need to restrain American power while we can. The dude had his hand on the nuclear button. He gave the initiative to start wars to others rather than controlling that decision ourselves. The risks he generated in the system live on. Like, to unfuck all this is going to be really hard, and it's going to take a long time. And so we have an obligation to society, if we value peace in any way, to tie the hands of future American presidents from doing the kinds of bad things we've done in foreign policy since the Bush era, or arguably even before that. We need to make it harder, not easier, to wage war.
Things That Go Boom is produced by Inkstick Media and distributed by PRX. This episode was produced by Maren Lazian and me, and edited by Ruth Morris and John Barth. Darian Shulman is the incredible composer behind our show's music, and Robin Wise makes everything sound shiny and new. Thank you, as always, to the foundations that make our work possible: the Carnegie Corporation of New York and Plowshares Fund, as well as Inkstick supporters, including the Colomb Foundation, Craig Newmark Foundation, Prospect Hill Foundation, and the Jubitz Family Foundation. If you want to hear more from us, come visit us on social at Inkstick Media, and we'll see you right back here in 2 weeks.